Good morning, everyone. We're reading in book two, the book of the Traveler of the Worlds, canto four, The Kingdom's Little Life. In this canto, King Aswapati, on his exploration of the planes of existence, has come to the level of the first emergence of life in material form. And in the canto, he shows us three levels of that stage. The first tells how life emerges almost totally under the domination of matter. Those little beings, they can hardly move. They can't last for long. If we came from another planet and saw this stage happening, we might think that, nothing much is going to happen here. But King Aswapati is able to see that this first stage is a preparation for many further stages, a necessary stage, the yeast and molds and slimes and bacteria and viruses and then the amoebas and other simple single-celled creatures. So then he shows us a second level where life is more dynamic and prominent because it's a kingdom of the animal self. And actually there are several different levels of development, and the last one which he shows us is the appearance of beings who wear a more or less human form, but who are not yet fully human in their consciousness. They're not yet really mental beings. And now, in the last section of the canto, we just started to read it last time. He says, a third creation now revealed its face. A mold of body's early mind was made. This is an important stage in the development of mind in living beings. We actually read a little further on page 147 to the end of first sentence, but I think we'll start at the break on page 146 today. We can read the whole section. I think we have read it already.
Yeah,
we have gone through the whole section. This time we'll look at it in more detail. Shall we start at the top today? Hong, you would like to read? You will read? At the break on page 146. Page 146. Have you got the place?
A third creation now.
That's right. That's where we are going to read from. Sorry, we keep interrupting you. Please go ahead. A third creation.
A third creation now reveals its face. A model of bodies already mind was made. A glimpse of light kindled of pure world force. It towers a living world with the same idea. An arm, the axe, with such dynamic point. A small thinking being was the work of time. A difficult evolution from below. Called the mass incorporation from above. As this great blind intention emerged, could never have disclosed its significance. mind, or even in rivers, work in this and man. The intelligence that divides the cosmic system.
Scheme. Thank you. We spoke about these lines a little bit last week, but has anybody got anything they would like to ask about this passage that was just read? A lint. It's a little shine of light. So this appearance of mind consciousness, the first emergence of mind and living bodies, it's like a little gleam of light. And that gleam of light wakes something up in the obscure world force and the nature which is ruling that stage of development. That world has been driven by powers acting from behind, which we shall read about in the next canto. But that little glint of light, of mind consciousness, gives to that driven world a seeing force, a force that can see, observe what is happening, so that all this automatic action gets given a more dynamic point, a possibility of aim and purpose. A small thinking being watches the works of crime. We don't know what those beings were like. They had some kind of human form, and I think the earliest humanoid form that we know about is this little being they call Lucy, that they discovered in the Rift Valley in Ethiopia. A small female being, they call her Lucy, which means light, actually. And Sri Aurobindo says that this new development has been brought about because there's been a kind of call or an attraction from a difficult evolution from below. This whole evolution of primitive life forms from matter to bring things to this stage has been very difficult. But now it seems the moment is ready, and there's an intervention from above, but that comes masked, disguised. It doesn't show itself clearly. But unless there had been that intervention from above, he says, this blind, inconscient universe, the material universe, could never have disclosed its hidden mind. Within it, of course, there was a mind. He calls it the intelligence that devised the cosmic scheme. There has been a plan, a purpose, an intelligence, a supreme intelligence at work from the very beginning of this creation. But in its early stages, it is masked. So unless some pressure had come from above, this involved mind couldn't have begun to work, even in blinkers. We talked about that last time, the eye shades that are put on working animals when they have to go into crowded places. Yes? Yeah, there's the involved divine who's here in all the forms of the universe. And there's the overt divine on the higher level. And what we see in Sri Aurobindo's symbol, it's the way that these two aspects of the divine interact. And he's mentioned it also in his little book, the Mana, that there are two powers that are needed. One is the aspiration that calls from below, and then there's the response of the grace from above. So gradually there's a kind of a bootstrap effect. There's a very interesting science fiction novel from the 50s, I think, called The Bootstrap Effect, which describes how this consciousness from below calling and the intervention and then lifting up. So something like that is happening here. The intelligence that devised this cosmic scheme is able to rescue a little bit of its involved self, lift it up to a more conscious level. Does that make sense to you? So how does Asvapati see this happening? That's what comes in the next passage. Srinivas Murti, would you read? Thank you. So it's a very interesting picture that Aurobindo gives of world existence like a kind of ocean. And in this ocean of force, Asvapati sees this dim, very faintly lit, obscure, unclear mind power. He sees it moving, but it's hidden, concealed by matter and this dumb life, this life, early life that is unable to express itself clearly and fully. He sees it just as a thin current amidst this vast flow of life force that's like a rough sea tossing and drifting under a drifting sky, a sky full of drifting clouds. He sees that little current that's in the midst of this waves and this glimmering, tremulous wash, as if the ocean itself is in half darkness. But that little current gets released here and there in splashes of sensation and feeling. In the ocean there are waves of sense impressions and emotions, and that's where that little mind power gets released. Here in this edition we have in the deep midst of an insentient world, a world without sense impressions. I think in the earlier edition you've got unconscious, no? Mother reads unconscious. So these waves packed close together, this foam of consciousness, of this thin current of mind power, it's as if it's being forced through a very narrow passage. So there's quite some power behind, but when that gets compressed, it's pressing and eddying in whirlpools through a narrow strait, a place where the water is confined, borders on both sides. And this mind current is carrying experience in its crowded base. The base is the movement, the speed. It's getting carried along swiftly, many different experiences. And then it flows, coming out into the upper light. It's no longer in this darkness of the lower levels. It flows up from the deep pool of its subliminal birth. This current of mind power is born or finds its source deep in the subliminal consciousness, in that deeper level of consciousness which connects us with the universal consciousness. So it's pressing upwards to reach some high existence still unknown. This is an exploratory, transient stage. My mind hasn't fully emerged yet. Chitra,
I think you said,
so this is what Asvapati sees first, is this thin current of obscure mind power. And at this level, there's no thinking individual. There's no aim in this movement. Everything was unorganized stress, pressure, vague seekings. And up to the unstable surface of mind, of consciousness, rose occasional sensations, stabs and edges of desire, suddenly intense feelings, passions, leaps, briefs, emotions, cries, a casual colloquy of flesh with flesh. When bodies contact each other, there is some kind of communication going on, a murmur of heart, a longing, wordless heart. These things happen occasionally. Glimmerings of knowledge, faint gleams of understanding, but no form, shape of thought, and little jets like little shoots of water, subconscious will coming up from the subconscious, or the pull of hunger. So at this stage, all this flow, this current thing, it took the form of, or these little emergences of mind consciousness are like dim sparkle on foaming top. On top of the water there are lots of bubbles and some light falls on it, and there's a sparkle of light. And all that current is whirling around a drifting shadow self. This individual hasn't formed fully yet. But there is a kind of center, like there seems to be a center to a whirlpool. It's whirling around a drifting shadow self on an inconscient flight of force in time. So time is passing, its flow is going on, things are developing. Lena, did you read?
Then came the natural symbol. The dream all into dancing forming mass, serving around the single room of faith, sombre awareness and heart of food. Figure of the detailed life event, the breathing voice of the half sentient breath.
So this is a new development. There's a pressure from a seeing power. This is an intervention from above, a pressure, and that pressure has a certain power of vision, a seeing power. And that draws all this vague flow of disconnected experiences. It draws it all together. It's still moving, it's turbid, it's still muddy and troubled. But it's circling around a single luminous point as a center of consciousness. It's the center of reference in a conscious field. It's the beginning of an individualization. And that single luminous point, that center, it's a figure, it's an expression of a unitary life, light within. As if there's the beginning of a being, and in the center of it, there's a unifying consciousness. So that process lights up the impulse, the pressure of this half-sentient flood of sense and emotions. It even gives the appearance and illusion of something fixed, as if that scene, that dancing turbid mass could serve as a firm soil, a basis, a foundation. That strange observing power imposed its sight. It gives some kind of organization. Forces on all this flow a limit, a shape. It gives its stream, its flow, a narrow lower bank, a lower narrow bank. Drew lines to snare the spirit's formlessness, as if it catches spirit within certain limits. This power fashioned the life mind. That's the label Shobindo puts on this level of development, the life mind of bird and beast, the answer of the reptile and the fish, and it also, this level is the primitive pattern of the thoughts of man. We have within us a reptilian brain here, at the top of the spine, or perhaps it belongs to this level of evolution. It's not really thinking, but it responds, it reacts, shows purpose. Do you like to read?
The finer movement of the individual will make its way to the wide field of time. A march of knowledge moves to mission, and God is the full separate soul. His right to be immortal is deserved, but build a wall against the siege of death, and through a hook to clutch eternity. A thinking entity to fill in space, a little old world broke into view. The being had prison room for act and sight. A golden wall, a clear but scanty way, an instrument personality was born, and a restricted plant intelligence, incentive to confine in narrow bounds. It's seeking, the time that thought to visible things, prohibiting the adventure of the unseen, and the soul thread tread through the unknown infinity.
Thank you. It's like a bird coming, no? A finite movement of the infinite, then winging its way through a wide air of time. As a result, in this nescience, a march of knowledge moved in nescience and guarded in the form. The forms have already been, have already appeared and emerged, no? Now it's able to protect there in the form a separate soul. It's come from above. It's a finite movement of the infinite. Perhaps it's the beginning of individual souls or of an individual soul. But it's not yet immortal. It has a right to be immortal, but it doesn't assert that right yet. It keeps it reserved. But what it does is, around the individual being, it builds a wall against that huge siege of death. Everything in the universe wants to devour it, no? And it's as if it throws up a sky hook to collect eternity. It wants to be connected with the eternal. It's come from the infinity and now wants to be connected with eternity. And the outcome of this is the appearance in space of a thinking entity. And once there are those thinking entities, the individual centers, then there appears this little ordered world where there's room for being and beings to have a very restricted room, prison room, for their actions, for their power of vision. There's a floor to work on, walk on, there's a basis, and there's a clear range. It's a scanty range, it's not enough, it's limited, but it is a clear range within which it can be. An instrument personality was born, a representative of that finite power of the infinite, and a restricted, clamped, tightly limited, tightly held intelligence accepts to confine its seeking to narrow bounds. So it ties this power of thought to visible things, prohibiting the adventure of the unseen and the soul's tread to unknown infinities. It's still very limited. Is that where we stopped?
We stopped at unknown infinities. We stopped at unknown infinities. Sudharu?
Yes.
This sense of immortality is more prominent among us. You know, we don't think and act as if I'm going to die in 20 years or 30 years. You know, we plan and act as if there is a tomorrow. This is not something.
So this is not yet a fully human stage, no? This is the beginning of the life mind, and perhaps this most primitive mind that we have, that operates on the base of our reptilian brain, maybe. That's what he says. The life mind of bird and beast, the answer of the reptile and the fish, the primitive pattern of the thoughts of man. I remember, actually many years ago, I was receiving some treatment for my back from a physiotherapist, very good physiotherapist here in Oroville, Joanne. And something that he did stimulated this brain in me. And I heard distinctly, "You have forgotten how to be a fish." Yeah, and that was very meaningful to me for a long time and helpful. So how a fish lives absolutely at ease and connected in its environment. We can think that environment is the unconscious, or the subconscious. But there it is, it's supported on all sides, it can't sink. Gives a very free possibility of movement. Nice to be a fish. Well, of course, until somebody catches you.
Driving in Indian roads, I always feel like there are fish around us, and you swim, they will move around you.
Oh, you trust.
Yeah, I trust. They are like a fish. They just fish move around you, and you can keep going.
No, I meditated on it quite a bit, and I wrote a poem which starts with being a fish in a fish bowl, and remembering what it was like to be in the ocean, but now you're in this bowl of the ego, and you can see out of your bowl, and that in a way it is nice, you're protected in a way from all the vastness of the universe. But maybe that bowl can break or get broken, and then what? And then maybe the fish dreams of one day escaping from the bowl, and the fins will become wings, and to be able to fly freely. Yes, that's the evolution of consciousness. One day we won't be confined in our little ego bowl. We'll be able to fly freely. And when that happens, yeah, it's another image that came perhaps round about the same time. You know, what are we afraid of, actually? What are we afraid of? There are many things that give us anxiety and fear. And the image came that it's as if there's a big sea wall, and on the other side of that sea wall, there's everything. And if the wall cracks and breaks, it will just come flooding in. What will you do then? And then I realized I will just fly up. Nothing will happen to me. I will just fly up. So these are nice ways that these images can help us. So, but you can see this is the beginning now of individuality, isn't it? An instrument personality is born. And there's a intelligence, but it's limited. That limitation prohibits us, in a way protects us from the adventure of the unseen and the soul's tread through unknown infinities. Yes? It means that it can be used by that higher power. It's a personality, it's a certain formation of reactions and qualities and so on, but it can be used by something higher. I think that's what it means. And there's that greater intelligence, no? That it accepts to be small in this instrument personality. You would read?
I read that reason, nature's habits, class of the way of life, you know, and fix its field. Accept the dangerous ignorance, brethren, and the inconclusive purpose of its law, and profit by the hour's precarious chance in the allotted boundaries of its will. A little joy and knowledge satisfy it. This will be the highest to the top. And come on the gold of this environment. A little curve set off in measureless space. A little span of life in all vast time. A thought was there to plan. A will that strove. But for small aims within a narrow scope, wasting unmeasured toil on transient things. It knew itself a creature of the mud. It asked no larger law, no loftier aim. It had no inward look, no upward gaze.
This is a first appearance of reason. But it's a reflex reason. It's basing its reflexes, its reactions, reflecting nature habit. It's a glass in the sense of a mirror. It's reflecting nature habit. But it is organized somehow into a reason that can has a certain process of logic and decision making. That reason illumined life to know and fix its field, that this is where I'm operating. It accepts a certain brevity, a short term action, which is dangerous, it can be lost, and it's ignorant. It has purpose, but its purpose is inconclusive as it moves. But it is able to profit by whatever chances and opportunities the moment brings within its allotted boundaries. When I read these things, I always think of my little cat. She's able to draw conclusions. I come out of one room and into this room, she thinks, oh, now there's a child, she'll feed me. If I make enough noise, she will feed me. And she accepts this order of things. She may sometimes wish that she could open doors, but she's given up on that. She accepts that she can't open the door, so she has to wait for other people to open the door. It's like this. But if there's a chance, whoops, out she will go. Or whoops, in she will come. And then she'll show that, look, I know the food is there. Give me some. Give it to me. This is some kind of planning even that's going on, but she has to accept the limitations. There's nothing she can do about it. The allotted boundaries of her fate. So Shobindra says this is like a little being. Maybe we can imagine a balloon, which has been, we used to do it when we were children. You blow up the balloon, not fully, and then you can tie off a little bit of the balloon. There's the big balloon and there's a little balloon. So the little being is like that, tied into a knot, hung onto a bulge of its environment. It's just a little curve of one lifetime in one body, cut off in all the measureless space, which has a little span of life in all vast time. So in that little being, connected to its environment, inseparably connected, but yet in a way separate, it has a thought that can plan, a will that's striving to get fulfilled, but its aims are very small, very restricted, wasting unmeasured toil on transient things. I think we do this too. Put so much effort into things that really are hardly worth it. And anyway, they're soon gone. This little reason knows that it's a creature of the mud, it's an earth creature. And it doesn't ask for any larger law, no higher aim. It doesn't look within. It doesn't look above. This is the life mind, part of the animal creation. Manu, how would you read? Yes.
Backwards fallen along its rigid bench, indoctrinated by the erring sense. It took appearance for the face of God, for casual lights, the marching of the suns, for heaven, a starry streak of doubtful blue. Aspects of being came to be the wood. There was the voice of this future change, a marketplace of trivial thoughts and acts, a life full spent, a mind, the body's slave, piercing the brilliant crown of nature's world. And tiny people took the world as a means to save a while what lusts and brief desires. In a very close passage, so life starts and ends. And through the blind alley where creation signs, as it forbids the soul of conquered birth in the wonderland of a self-creating world, and the opportunities of cosmic space.
Thank you. This is this reflex reason. Rickety. The bench is very unsteady. It can fall apart at any moment. Oh, logic can be like that. No? But this reason is even a backward scholar. He's not very good at logic. It's as if he's been brainwashed by the senses, which anyway are erring, which don't give us accurate information. So the conclusions it draws, it sees all these appearances, and it thinks, yes, that is the truth, that's how things are. And the looking up to the night sky, the marching of the suns, it feels these are just meaningless, these casual lights. It sees this starry strip of doubtful blue and thinks, that is heaven. Aspects of being to this reflex reason. They pretended to be at the appearance of being the whole. At the same time, between such minds, there's a voice of busy interchange, a marketplace of trivial thoughts and acts. Mother says if we really observe our mind in connection with the minds around us, it's like this, a bazaar. A marketplace of trivial thoughts and acts. So in this stage, this brief life that's soon spent, this mind which is driven by the body, the slave of the body. This seems to be the supreme achievement of nature. Mm-hmm. And tiny egos, and they have the right to use everything they can in the world, take the world as means to sate for a little while, to satisfy their dwarf lusts and brief desires. They see that, oh yes, there's death. Mm-hmm. They see that they think that this one life is the beginning and end of everything, life start and end. Shobindo mocks the mind. He says, as though a blind alley, a cul-de-sac, a closed street, can that be a sign of creation? Is that what it's going to be, just a dead end? As if for this the soul had coveted birth, decided to come into the material world, coveted birth in this wonderland of a self-creating world and all the opportunities of cosmic space. Would we have come for this little life, this primitive mind driven by the needs of the body? Would that be a sufficient reason for all this manifestation? There must be something more to it.
The
education
process, we cannot simply be the whole truth for this energy. So it's a part of the truth. And the truth it has to be.
Of course. That's where creation is going. But these are the necessary small steps on the way. And if we look at those small steps in themselves, we may think, my goodness, that can't be worth it. But they're leading on to something else. That is their significance. It's very, very interesting and instructive to know about the past. But what's really important is the future. Where are we going? Perhaps this information about the past can help us to see where we might be going. Not in such detail, Bhuvana. I think this is the... Yes, she sees different levels of the individual human self at our level. She sees that there's a realm which is dominated by the senses, there's a realm which is driven by the life force, there are levels of mind, and she has to pass through all that to find the way to her soul. In her, she's doing all this work in her individual body at the beginning of that entry into the inner countries. She's shown that you are here to do as human beings must do. You must find your soul within your material body, and those are the levels that she passes through. These are the levels of cosmic existence. I don't think anywhere else Shobindo has explained in such detail all this. We read about the golden ladder carrying the soul. No? These are the rungs of the ladder, up which the soul can go, down which it has come into the evolution.
The mother has got three aspects. One is individual mother, the other one is universal mother, and the third one is
transcendent
mother. Maybe this is...
The divine expresses himself, always, constantly, continually, in these three ways. expresses himself through the individual self. That's why this instrumental personality has to be built up. So that the divine, indwelling divine, can express through the individual. But all this work and this intervention is coming from the universal self. That's where the pressure is coming for each new step. And beyond the universe, beyond the manifestation, there's the freedom of the transcendent, which is upholding all this and allowing all this to happen. Enveloped, and not only surrounded, but pervaded. The transcendent has no limits. So it's here in everything, as well as beyond everything. It's not limited by any of its creation, actions or behavior. Shall we read a little further? Who would be next? Narayan?
This creature that she had only to survive, fettered with clinging thoughts with no wide range, and with the body's need and pangs and joys, this fire going from its fullest depth, increased by what it sees and made it own. It gathered and grew and gave itself none. Only hope, forgiveness in its band, and pleasure and victory in small things of power, and conquest of life wound for self and kin, an animal limited by experience base. It knew not the immortal in its house, it had no greater either cause to live. In limits only it was powerful. A true perfection took for outward use. Its knowledge was the body's instrument. Absorbed in the little works of its prison house, it turned around the same unchanging points, in the same circle of interest and desire, but thought itself the master of its dream. Although for action, not for wisdom made, thought was its apex, or its gutter's rim. It saw an image of the external world, and saw its surface self, but knew no more. Out of a slow, confused, embroiled self-search, mind grew to a clarity cut out, precise, a beam enclosed in its own ignorance.
Thank you. Anything to ask or share? We can recognize this little mind, no? Sorry?
The same thing you made from animal being fetched within its and it's going around and around.
Yes, that's the material body. And this is the animal mind that goes with that body. Yes. It comes at the very beginning. Yeah. Canto 2. It's a development, no? Mind is growing. It's becoming more precise. In the universal context, it's just a gleam, a faint light, enclosed in a stone ignorance. It's acute, it's sharp, clever, at catching hold of things that seem true, so that it can use them for its purposes. Well, with my little cat, for instance, if she can trick me into doing what she wants, it's like that. Satisfying your wishes and your dies and desires. But there's no inward look, there's no sense even that there is anything within to be caught, understood. So let's just read to the end. Mina, are you going to read? Jerry can read.
found three things in their leadership: eyes and soul, inspired by common things, attached to a confined familiar world, and with the multitudes of her voted thoughts, her changing actors of her moving minds, life as a play, monotonously the same. There was no vast perspectives of spirit, no swift intelligence of unknown delight, no golden distances of life to be. This majesty resembled our wounds, but fixed in eternity of changeless time, enormous movement doomed to last through time, a distance which like span the inconstant worlds, a half illumined building in the mist, which from a void of form arose to sight, and left it out into a void of soul. A little light in the great darkened mind, life knew not vacant nor unsecured. Around all felt the spirit, the nesting place,
Thank you. So at this stage, life is led by the mind, but it's led by this bound thinking, this narrow leadership. Life is tied to the soil, to the earth, inspired by common things, attached to a confined, familiar world. But still, what she loves most is variety. She, even under these restricted conditions, she creates her multitude of motive plots, her changing actors, million masks. She can do all that, but still, because of the limitations, life was a play, monotonously the same. And then he says, this petty state resembled our human days. Our lives are like this. But fortunately, in our world, the wonderful thing about world is that it's a world of change and progress. What Aswapati is seeing there is a universal plane which is fixed to eternity of changeless state. It's always like that. If the soul passes through there, it will see the same thing. No change. But we are not fixed to eternity of changeless state. We can always move further on. That's the great blessing. So Aswapati is seeing existence like a great bridge over all the gulfs, the deeps of inconscience. He's seeing it like a half-illumined building in a mist. And like a bridge, it's rising out of the lower levels where there's no form, formlessness, a void of form. And it's rising up into another formlessness, the formlessness of soul, of spirit. And in this great structure, life is there as a little light in a great darkness born. Even with the help of this little reflex reason, it has no idea where it's going or where it has come from. And around all this life structure floated still the nescient haze. There was no real knowledge as such yet. You might think that the next cantos would lead on to mind, to the development of mind. But that doesn't come until Canto 10. We still are dealing with words. And in the next canto, which is quite a long one, Asvapati is going to explore the inwardness of this world, these kingdoms of the little life. What are subtle beings that are behind controlling and helping all this? The Godheads of the little life. And then on his journey, he reaches the kingdoms and Godheads of the greater life. But he finds that it's at a higher level, in a way it's much more satisfying. It even seems to us perhaps the best that humanity can achieve in the life aspect. But it's still so limited, and he feels imprisoned in it. He can't escape. So how could he reach that realm of griefless life which he was shown in Canto 3? He still wants to know how that can be done. And in order to find out why he can't reach there, he realizes he has to go down, right down into all the lower levels, and find out where this unhappy magic has its cause. And so there are cantos 7 and 8, very, very difficult, painful cantos for us to read and for Asvapati to experience. But at the end of Canto 8, he does find the clue that he was looking for. He found the secret key of nature's change. And then he doesn't have to go anywhere. He's just immediately projected into the paradise of the life god. And he stays there for a very short time just to receive the healing of all the wounds that he's experienced in Canto 7 and 8. And then he moves on to the worlds of mind. Canto 10, Canto 11, Canto 12, Canto 13. And then he reaches the world soul, and he meets the mother, and she carries him into the kingdom of greater knowledge, which is the last canto in book two. So we'll stop there for today. Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.